Welcome to the Forum, live streamed worldwide from the Leadership Studio at the Harvard T.H. Chan School of Public Health. I'm Dean Michelle Williams. The Forum is a collaboration between the Harvard Chan School and independent news media. Each program features a panel of experts addressing some of today's most pressing public health issues. The Forum is one way the school advances the frontiers of public health and makes scientific insights accessible to policymakers and the public. I hope you find this program engaging and informative. Thank you for joining us.
All right, good morning, everyone. My name is Margot Sanger-Katz. I'm a reporter at The New York Times, and I want to introduce our panelists, starting with Bob, who is sitting next to me. Robert Blendon is a professor of health policy and political analysis at the Harvard T.H. Chan School of Public Health and the Harvard Kennedy School. Sarah Collins is the vice president of healthcare coverage and access at the Commonwealth Fund. John McDonough is a professor of the practice of public health at the Harvard T.H. Chan School of Public Health. Adam Gaffney is an instructor of medicine at Harvard Medical School, a pulmonary and critical care specialist at the Cambridge Health Alliance, and the current president of Physicians for a National Health Program. And Phil Ellis is the president of Ellis Health Policy. This event is being presented in collaboration with the Commonwealth Fund. We are streaming live on the website of the Forum. We are also streaming live on Facebook and YouTube. So we're here to talk about healthcare in the election. And when I first came to Washington, the first election I covered was in 2012, and healthcare was sort of starting to get up there. It was like number two in the issues that were of interest to voters. And everyone said, oh, we've never seen this before. It's always other things. And since then, it just seems like it has come to occupy a very high ranking spot. And indeed, in many surveys that we see now, healthcare is sort of number one voter concern, and particularly so for Democratic voters. So we are likely to have another election in which healthcare figures prominently, and we're so lucky to have these panelists talk about what is being proposed and how it is likely to play out. We have a bunch of really different visions among the Democratic candidates. Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren have both endorsed Medicare for All proposals, which would provide kind of universal government-provided health care to everyone with really generous benefits, no premiums, no copays, no deductibles. And then we also have quite a lot of Democrats, including Joe Biden and Pete Buttigieg, who are want to really have an optional but kind of expansive government health plan that more people would be able to buy coverage directly from the government. And then, of course, we have President Trump and the Republicans who tried and failed to repeal the Affordable Care Act a few years ago, and I think are have a very different vision, at the very least, sort of a status quo vision, and perhaps something that would make changes that would have fewer regulations, more autonomy for the states, probably a little bit less expensive, less comprehensive insurance in their vision. So we're going to have a chance to explore the implications of all of this, both politically and practically. And to set the stage, we're going to take a look at a clip from Reuters. This came out in November, just as Elizabeth Warren was releasing her Medicare for All proposal.
Democratic presidential candidate Elizabeth Warren said on Friday she won't have to raise taxes on the middle class to pay for Medicare for All. Warren said her health care plan would cost the U.S. government an extra $20.5 trillion over 10 years, but said it would save American households $11 trillion in current out-of-pocket spending. The senator from Massachusetts has faced criticism from her 2020 Democratic rivals on how she could possibly afford such a sprawling plan. Warren has maintained the plan will largely be financed through businesses and the wealthy. The plan would replace private insurance, including employer-sponsored plans, with full Medicare coverage, and individuals would no longer have to pay premiums, deductibles, copays, or similar out-of-pocket costs. Long-term care would also be covered. More moderate candidates like Joe Biden and Pete Buttigieg have said Medicare for All would be too expensive. They favor a more incremental approach. Despite recent scrutiny, Warren has maintained her spot at or near the top of the pack in opinion polls.
Win!
So that clip is also a great reminder for everyone to get your flu shot. Bob, we did this survey recently with the Commonwealth Fund and the Harvard School of Public Health, asking voters and normal Americans sort of what they think about the various choices before them and what are some of the reasons why they favor one policy or another. Can you give us an overview of what we found?
So quickly, if you follow the news very closely, something odd's been going on. One Monday, you pick up the news and it says 55% of Americans favor improving the ACA. Then the next Monday, it says 56% of Americans favor Medicare for All. Then the following Monday, it says 44% of Americans want to repeal and replace the ACA. Now, I don't want to overdo being at Harvard, but it adds up to more than 150%. What we did is we interviewed people across the country, said, look, you have to pick the one you most favor. And we weren't sure. Maybe people can't do this. Maybe everybody would say, I don't know. But actually, 90% of people said, I actually do have one I favor. And then we wanted to take a look at, are the people different at this random? Just you happen to pick up the telephone and say, I like this today. Well, it turns out it's not random. And so I'm going to summarize quickly just what we have, and then we'll just look at PowerPoints, mostly for people far away who just want to say, I don't know exactly what he said, but I can look at it later. First, when you give people the three choices, the three choices were improving the ACA, Medicare for All, and replacing the ACA with essentially a state-based and something like many of the Republicans may have altered. It turns out you have to pick one. The nation is instantly divided by three. However, when you look at it by party, because it's the Democratic primary, it's very important. So the two, ACA and Medicare for All, are tied in a Democratic primary. And the third Republican option is not very well thought of. If you actually interview Republicans, they really like the Republican option. And so the majority of them favor that. So in the Democratic side, the thing you have to understand is both sides absolutely believe in universal coverage, and the United States has to move and get everybody covered. That's not true on the Republican option. So are there differences? And we'll look at this very quickly. So just among the ACA versus Medicare for All, the people who favor Medicare for All have a stronger view of what they want the government to do in the future in healthcare. Not a big surprise, but they do. Secondly, and when you're in healthcare, you think every attitude is just driven by how I feel about my doctor visit and my insurance. It turns out people who favor Medicare for All are much more critical of the U.S. economic system. People who favor the ACA are much more positive about the U.S. So it's not just how I feel about my doctor and hospital and insurance. The ACA people are more favorable to employer insurance than people who choose Medicare for All. And the Medicare for All people are more worried about, on a personal level, their personal health care costs in the future. So we'll look at this quickly. Because it is the Democratic primary we're covering, I'll just focus very briefly. Let's go, we'll do these just very quickly. So this is the whole general public. And you could see there's almost a three-way tie. When people say, and very few people opted out, saying, oh no, I can't make a choice. They actually, at some gut level, can make a choice. Next slide. This is simple. The blue bar are Democrats. And what you see is they're tied, and there's not a lot of interest in the Republican plan. And the red bars are Republicans that aren't interested in the two other plans. Margo was covering a Republican primary, she would not be writing about Medicare for All. It would not be whoever the Republican Elizabeth Warren was on the stage. For that, next. This is a question that Gallup has asked for 30 years. And it's just a simple one. What would you prefer in the future, a health insurance system run by government or one run by private insurance? It's not ideal. You just can follow for 30 years. And what you discover is the Medicare for All pick the government very heavily. The ACA people are over half, but nowhere where the Medicare for All. And if you can't see the bottom of the bar, the Republicans have no interest in those who favor a Republican-oriented plan in a government-run health insurance system. So for those who read the Times very, very quickly, when they say the nation is polarized, this is what polarized looks like. Next one. And so this is just your view about the American economic system. Is it positive or negative? And would you discover the Medicare for All are more negative than positive? Not true of those who prefer the ACA or those who prefer a more Republican-oriented state plan. So there is an underlying belief among the Medicare for All group that something is really wrong in the United States for the overall economic system, as well as the healthcare system. Next slide. And so if you look at the satisfaction with their own cost of care, again, the Medicare for All are the most dissatisfied of the three groups. So costs might be the same, but their interpretation of that for themselves is very different between the three groups. And then the last, then we can. So the question is thinking about private health insurance provided by employers. How do you feel about it? Favorable or not favorable? And as you could see, those who prefer building on the ACA and those Republican plan are much more positive about employer health insurance today in the United States than those who favor Medicare for All. So there are underlying values and beliefs that drive the choices that are there. But the important takeaway for this is the debate has just begun. When you have a three-way split in the United States, the answer has not been decided by sweeping public opinion. It's in fact, the debate has just begun, and I think that's what the discussion is today is about.
So, Sarah, I was hoping you could give us a little bit of an overview of sort of like where we are, why there seems to be so much urgency among Democrats and to some degree Republicans to do something different with the healthcare system than what we have right now. What's happening now with the cost of healthcare that may be driving some of that?
No, that's a great question. I just want to thank you. And also on behalf of the fund, Commonwealth Fund, thank the Harvard School of Public Health for this forum. I'm just going to do that. I'm going to briefly review where we stand on health insurance coverage and then also just give a little, just a really brief overview of a little more meat on the what these candidates are actually proposing. But after it dropped considerably after the Affordable Care Act's passage, the uninsured rate in the United States has really, it's flattened out. It's really not, we're not really seeing any gains. And in fact, we've seen a little bit of an uptick in the rate. About 27 to 30 million people are currently uninsured, including about 2 to 4 million people in states that haven't yet expanded eligibility for Medicaid. At the same time, the number of working age adults who are insured all year but have but are underinsured has risen to about 44 million people. So these are people with high out-of-pocket costs and deductibles relative to their income. In employer plans, where about 150 million people get their insurance coverage, affordability overall is declining. The workers' premium contributions for these health plans and their deductibles, again, relative to their income, is climbing pretty significantly. In the individual market, after a few years of volatility, the ACA marketplaces are pretty stable. The premium subsidies have really helped people afford coverage in the individual market. But people with incomes that are just over that threshold that makes them eligible for subsidies are really finding those premiums to be pretty unaffordable. And deductibles can also be quite high in the individual market for people who aren't eligible for cost-sharing subsidies. And I think it's likely that these costs, the premium costs, the out-of-pocket costs that people are now exposed to, particularly through deductibles, are really fueling this concern and angst we're seeing among voters about their healthcare costs and their fear of not being able to afford their care in the future. Well, most people don't really spend that much out of pocket every year. High deductibles and this risk of high spending is really what's driving anxiety. All of the leading Democrats are proposing plans to address these issues of coverage and costs that we're seeing in the system. They But I think when you think about these plans, so just trying to understand what people are proposing, it's really important to remember that the U.S. system right now, health system, insurance system, is a mix of both public and private insurance coverage and a mix of both public and private financing. So just with that frame, trying to understand what these candidates are proposing. All of them are seeking universal coverage. They're doing so with different paths, or proposing different paths. But they're similar in that they're proposing to build out the public side of our insurance system. Vice President Biden and Mayor Buttigieg would build on the ACA by Affordable Care Act by adding more public features to private insurance, adding a public plan option for people to choose alongside a private plan, and importantly, allowing people in employer-based plans to purchase that coverage through this public option. Senators Warren and Sanders are clearly at the end of this public insurance continuum and would make a public plan like Medicare their primary, the primary source of coverage for most Americans. But I also think it's really important to point out right now where we are in the campaign that both Sanders and Warren are proposing transition plans to a Medicare for All type system that's similar in structure to plans that build on the Affordable Care Act. So I guess the bottom line is that these candidates are on the same page in terms of reaching universal coverage and improving affordability. And their proposed mechanisms for getting there, at least when you consider the transition plans of Warren and Sanders, are relatively similar in structure.
So John, you were involved in writing the ACA and have been watching it unfold. Can you just tell us a little bit about sort of what this journey has been, what you think the ACA has achieved, and where maybe it has fallen short a little bit?
Sure. So,
and I advised everyone not to say ACA, and I just did. So that's the Affordable Care Act, also known as Obamacare.
Thank you, Marga. And so nobody's mentioned it, so I get to. So we're just 2 months shy of the 10th anniversary of the signing of the ACA on March 23rd. So it'll be 10 years old. So it's entering adolescence. And by comparison, this year is the 55th birthday for Medicare and Medicaid. Occurred to me recently that in the year 2030, 10 years from now, Medicare will be eligible for Medicare. Unless, of course, Congress lowers the age of eligibility and that throws that. So just a few things to keep in mind as we think about the ACA again in this election year and in the context of 10 years down this road and the main achievements. So the ACA succeeded in reducing the number of uninsured in the United States by about 20 million, give or take, both through the Medicaid expansions and the private health insurance expansions through the marketplaces. And it brought the rate of uninsurance down to the lowest level overall that it's been in since we've been counting the number of uninsured, below 9%. So that's a significant piece. It's just worth saying, in contrast, of course, every other advanced nation on the planet, whether they're single payer or multi-payer, has an uninsurance rate between 0 and 1%. So it's great to be below 9% because it's the best we've been, and it's not really good enough, and that's worth keeping in mind. The other thing that's happened, one of the major accomplishments, has been revolutionizing the regulation and conduct of private health insurance in the United States. So the ability for insurance companies to write you a policy or manage your coverage based upon your prior or current medical history is illegal in all 50 states for the first time in history as of January 1st, 2014. And that means the elimination of pre-existing condition exclusions, medical underwriting, and has proven to be, I think, one of the most popular and durable, politically durable parts of the ACA.
We just heard the president tweeting about it today.
And was a revolution. Was a revolution, really. Not as revolutionary as Medicare for All or what Bernie Sanders would like, and revolutionary on its own terms. The third piece is addressing costs. We hear a lot that the ACA did nothing to address costs. There's a major part of the law that really made a serious, significant, concerted effort to get at costs by trying to change the underlying financing of the system away from a payment form called fee-for-service, where providers get rewarded simply for how many procedures they do, and moving toward a value-based framework that pays based upon efficiency, effectiveness, and quality of care. We are far down that road. There is an immense amount of activity going on in all 50 states, regardless of their political feelings about Obamacare, the Affordable Care Act. It has not produced the stellar, wonderful results that I think many people hoped. And it is also producing some demonstrable improvements in efficiency and quality as well. Things like accountable care organizations and bundled payment. We could spend hours talking about that, and no one will know what I'm talking about, so I'll get away from that. But we're down that road, and again, it's a similar story. The ACA has made significant, serious progress, and not nearly enough. More needs to be done, and so the challenge is, in terms of moving then to the next stage, what is the appropriate platform to aim for, and that's what we're talking about here today.
Adam, I feel like in some ways, this debate within the Democratic Party is one about sort of incrementalism versus transformation. Mm-hmm. And I know, you know, you've been an advocate for a Medicare for All approach, which is the more transformational approach. Can you talk a little bit about why you think that it is the better approach instead of just, you know, building, you know, mm-hmm. piece by piece as we did with the ACA?
Sure. Well, I think it pertains to a lot of the problems that we've heard about already in terms of the issues that Americans are facing with their health care. And I think that Medicare for All is the reform that would most fully address those problems. I mean, we heard a lot about uninsurance. Just to reiterate, 29 million people uninsured currently. And as Sarah mentioned, that's gone up a little bit during the Trump era. The CBO estimates it will rise further in the coming decade. And we know that, you know, these people are going without needed health care, going bankrupt, or at least having collections agencies chase after them if they do get health care. And an increasing growing body of literature is suggesting or is demonstrating that being uninsured is tantamount to a threat to your life itself, that mortality is higher. Not surprising. And, you know, certainly for those of us on the provider side, we see the ramifications of that in terms of, you know, in my practice, being in the ICU and seeing someone there with complications of a chronic illness that wasn't treated because of lack of coverage or a short lapse in coverage. But I actually think the more salient issue from the discussion in terms of politically is probably the healthcare cost problem facing insured Americans. As Sarah mentioned, 44 million working age adults are classified as underinsured, meaning they have insurance, but it's inadequate because the copays or deductibles are too high. And again, that is causing people to go without needed health care. There was a recent study that found that women with breast cancer and a high deductible health care plan actually delay diagnosis, biopsies, and even the initiation of chemotherapy. And that's just one example of the kind of health ramifications of the crisis of underinsurance. And for both of those problems, Medicare for All does provide a very simple solution. It would cover all U.S. residents in both the bill in the House and the bill in the Senate that Senator Sanders introduced. And then from the perspective of underinsurance, it would provide coverage without copays or deductibles. A generous coverage design that is similar to what we have in Canada and in the UK, with some exceptions. Finally, I think the other side of this, and this is a little more salient, I think, from the provider side, is the potential savings from a Medicare for All reform. A study came out last week that found that about $812 billion is spent annually just to cover the costs of healthcare administration in the United States, things like billing and administration in hospitals or insurance companies. And that's about a third of total U.S. healthcare spending. And that proportion is approximately double Canada. So that gives you a sense of the potential savings from transitioning to a more simple financing system. And those kinds of savings can then be used to cover the cost of covering the uninsured and upgrading coverage for the rest. So I think for those three reasons, which I'll stick with for right now, Medicare for All provides a unique set of tools to address really the key problems that are facing Americans today.
So Phil, this is a wonderful segue to what I wanted to ask you about, which is what is this all going to cost and how should we think about the various forms of new spending and savings associated with these different plans? So can you tell us a little bit about what we know about what Medicare for All will cost and also what some of these public option plans may cost.
Sure, happy to. So the reason I'm here is I worked at the Congressional Budget Office, or CBO, for a long time and did scoring for a living. So I don't want to be guilty of being the person who knows the price of everything and the value of nothing, so hopefully we can get into the discussion of the benefits of some of these plans, but just to lay out some of the cost parameters, I think you have sort of have three buckets of proposals. You have sort of things that take the ACA or Obamacare and, you know, boost it a bit, more subsidies, et cetera. You can get plans that cost between $300 billion and $1 trillion over 10 years. They don't cover everybody. There'll still be about 20 million uninsured, but that's an improvement of the ACA as one broad strategy. Then you can have plans that achieve universal or near universal coverage, but without disrupting the system, that work essentially within the ACA framework, within the existing employer insurance framework, and try to achieve universal coverage. Those have been costed out, and I'm referring mostly to a very nice study the Urban Institute did, funded by Commonwealth, that laid out these options nicely, and I commend to your attention. Those cost between $1.5 trillion and $2 trillion over 10 years, and these are federal costs. I'm focusing on the federal costs. We'll get into discussions of the effect on national health spending a bit later. And then you get to the Medicare for All, and the two options the Urban Institute looked at cost somewhere between $18 trillion or $34 trillion over 10 years. So, I mean, you can quibble about the assumptions that Urban made and come up with your own numbers, perhaps. But they're in the ballpark, and that gives you a sense of kind of the scale that we're talking about. I think it is useful to note, because this sometimes gets glossed over, the Medicare for All could be done in a number of ways. You can have cost sharing, as Medicare does. You can have premiums, as Medicare does. You can have private insurers delivering the benefit, as Medicare does. So there's a lot of, and the scope of the benefits is another thing you can vary. And so policies that are even under the Medicare for All label can differ somewhat substantially.
Can I interrupt for one question? Yeah. Will you just give us a sense of, like, how much is $1 trillion? Like, is there something that, you know, costs $1 trillion that we would be familiar with, or?
The ACA was about $1 trillion when it was passed, and funded by various funded by some tax increases and some payment cuts. I guess to give you a scale, the U.S. is projected to spend $52 trillion on health care over the next 10 years. So you can kind of see it from that perspective also. It is a big pie that we're digging into. Just very quickly, two things, and I hope we can get into the discussion of this, that may end up having an important effect on the debate, and things that actually brought the single-payer plan in Vermont to grief, which had a lot of momentum at one point, determining how much providers are paid, doctors, hospitals, and drug companies. The more you pay them, the more it costs, but the more you try to cut them, the more opposition you might get. And secondly, the tax increases that are involved. They're pretty substantial, $20 or $30 trillion, depending on the plan. $9 trillion in employer taxes in the Warren plan, for example. Again, to give you a scale there, the corporate income tax is projected to raise between $3 and $4 trillion over the next 10 years. Payroll taxes collecting $15 trillion. So this is a pretty big tax package. And finally, just from my experience on the Hill working in various health reform proposals, I'll just say, health reform is hard. It was hard to pass the Medicare drug benefit. It was hard to pass the ACA. They both kind of squeaked through. So don't underestimate the challenges ahead.
So this has been a good start. I want to dig a little bit deeper, but before we get too deep in the weeds, I do think that we ought to take a minute and just talk a little bit about the president's healthcare agenda. What, you know, we're in a primary now, and so a lot of the focus is on these Democratic plans, but eventually we're going to get to a general election, and presumably the president and Republicans in Congress are going to have some kind of healthcare plan to run on. I don't know, Sarah, maybe you can help us here. What, if anything, do we know about what that will be?
You know, we really don't know exactly what President Trump might run on. We do know what bills have looked like in the past. We know what the repeal and replace bills looked like in 2017, and we know what President Trump has done through regulation, through rulemaking, and what effects those have had. But we don't really know what the shape of those what he might run on will be.
If there's a pattern in terms of the administration's actions around things like association health plans, lengthening short-term insurance, this new individual coverage, health reimbursement accounts, different kinds of things that the public is overwhelmingly unaware of, they do go at attempting to make health insurance a lot cheaper by relaxing controls on things like protections against pre-existing conditions. So there is a trade-off here, and there is a clear pattern. The president, even this morning, is boasting about how he is the nation's prime protector of guarding against pre-existing conditions, but almost every initiative that they do in one way or another really tries to kind of move the ground away to let that back into the system in ways that I think would cause a lot of concern if people really focused on them.
In particular, often by splitting, instead of trying to unify the risk pool, as I think most of the Democratic proposals do, with the healthy and the sick all in it together and a little bit of cross-subsidization going on, splitting the risk pool so that healthier people can get less expensive health insurance, people with higher costs sometimes would be put into a high-risk pool, which in theory could cover them, but often those plans are very expensive. Many states have tried that and had not much success in expanding insurance coverage that way.
And I think the other thing we can point to is we have seen now over the past couple of years, for the first time in this decade or the last decade, an increase in the number of people without health insurance. I think the number's somewhere around 2 million. I haven't seen any tweets about that.
Yeah. And one question I think will be what Trump can get away with, in a sense, given that he now has a track record. In the last election, Trump was able to claim he would protect Medicaid. And that, I think was a popular position. But, shortly after being elected and inaugurated, he supported a bill that would have drastically cut funding for the Medicaid program. So with that track record behind him, will he be able to make claims of that sort? And I don't know.
So I want to come back to the numbers a little bit. And, I've highlighted this with my previous question, but I feel like some of these numbers, they seem big and they're kind of abstract. And it's just like, you hear in the bit about Senator Warren's plan, $20 trillion. It seems like a really big number. So I'm hoping you guys can give us a little context, first of all, for just the magnitude of these numbers. But also, Phil, as you said, we're projected to spend $52 trillion on healthcare already. We already spend a lot of dollars outside of the government on healthcare, people paying their premiums, employers are paying for health insurance, people are paying out of their pocket when they go to the doctor, state governments are paying through state taxes for their employees' healthcare and for Medicaid. How much of like 20, what does $20 trillion mean, and how much more is that than what we spend now? And, how do we think? I think Medicare for All uniquely brings a lot of stuff onto the government's books, and so it makes the total numbers of government spending seem big. But how does the total spending compare, and then how does the government spending compare in these various plans?
So like I say, I think we've got about, the system is currently split roughly 50-50 between public spending and private spending. And then the federal government has the majority of the public spending. But as you say, states kick in some also. So ballpark $25-26 trillion on each side of the ledger. And that is a challenge for the Medicare for All proposals if they're going to go have everything be federally funded. People can still end up paying less overall. That's certainly true, but it does show up on the government books. Most of the proposals, and again, I'm relying on the Urban Institute analysis, have relatively small effects on total healthcare spending. You can reduce, some of them, I think, increase national spending by $600 or $700 billion over 10 years. That's mostly because when you make things free for patients, they'll use more. That's not necessarily a bad thing. Again, price versus value. But they can, they'll on a base of $50 trillion or so, they'll increase that, 1% or decrease it 1%, but it's relatively small. Unless you start, obviously other countries spend a lot smaller share of their economy on healthcare than we do. They also pay quite a bit less to hospitals, doctors, and drug companies. And there is some room for administrative savings, but the estimates certainly differ a lot, I think, on how much of that can get squeezed out. There would still be some administrative costs in the new system.
Yeah, and I would just add to this, too. I mean, I think that you're right. The attention has really focused on this big increase in the federal spend. But what has gotten a lot less attention is the impact of a public option or public plan option and a full-fledged Medicare for All system on the underlying drivers of healthcare costs in the country right now. And that is mainly coming from the prices that commercial insurers pay to providers and principally hospitals. Both of these approaches, the plans that build on the Affordable Care Act by adding a public option and the Medicare for All proposals really do focus on that by trying to leverage down the prices that are paid closer or some distance away from Medicare rates.
And I think one thing that makes this a really important issue is that it is very confusing for the American public to separate out the question of federal financing versus overall national healthcare spending. You know, in my, you know, I think from an economic perspective and from a policy perspective, you know, what matters is what we're spending on healthcare as a nation, whether that money is being directed through Aetna and United Healthcare or whether it's being directed through the Medicare program. Doesn't really matter, but it does matter politically, because obviously you have to create taxes in order to change one form of financing to the other. But what I think makes healthcare a unique policy issue is that we are already spending plenty of money to do what we need to do. We're not talking about increasing the amount of money we're spending as a society on healthcare. We're talking about directing it in a different direction.
I think the difficulty is that most people, and according to your poll, Bob, most people still like their private employer health insurance. But primarily, I think a lot of that has to do with people don't understand what they're paying for it, because there's some piece, 5, 10, 15, 20% paid by the individual employee, and the rest is picked up by the employer. And so it's kind of hidden, and people, a lot of people think their piece is the total cost of their health insurance, and it's just not true. And so when you move to a Medicare for all system and you make it all explicit through taxation and everybody sees what they're paying, then that becomes kind of poisonous in terms of trying to advance it. And that was the problem they had in Vermont, where they had a solid program, a solid plan, but they were going to make it explicit, and it was like about an 11% payroll tax increase and a 9.5% income tax increase. And the governor, Peter Shumlin, who was a big champion of it, looked at those numbers and he just said, no mas, we just can't do it. It's not going to make it.
And I think that probably speaks to the reason, the sort of rationale in Warren's financing proposal for Medicare for All. She basically said that, you know, employers will spend about what they're spending now on healthcare. And it sort of takes, it sort of maintains that existing funding stream and doesn't sort of put it on, you know, transition into income tax, even though it would effectively be the same. It's a way to sort of say that you're not going to be spending more as a worker, that your employer will be spending the same.
But that's macro. And I think most people look at these proposals in a very micro way. What's it going to matter for me? And if they fear that they're going to end up on the short end, and most people are risk averse just by nature, that's what makes it really hard. And that's why financing has always been the black hole of single payer Medicare for all type proposals. When you get into the money conversation, people's heads explode and everybody runs for cover.
I wanted to talk a little bit about what the effects of these policies would be on the healthcare system itself. And I think there are differences between Medicare for All and some of these public option plans, but it seems like what both of them are doing is it's making more healthcare spending in the public system, and it is using that probably, right, to lower the amount that certain doctors and hospitals and drug companies and other providers of medical care are going to get paid, and is trying, you know, as Adam said, to reduce administrative cost. If you have this public payer, there will be maybe less complexity and less need to pay for some of the things that we pay for now. So what does that look like? Whose life looks different under these proposals, and how, you know, what does it mean if you work for an insurance company, for example? What does it mean if you work for a hospital? What does it mean if you're maybe one of those administrative staff?
I can get us started, maybe. Yeah. So I think actually for physicians, the change will be relatively modest. I mean, you'll have less time spent, you know, during your workday on billing and administrative activities, and you may need to hire less people to negotiate with multiple insurance companies and to sort of interact with payers. You know, one estimate says, projected that about $80,000 are spent in this country per physician to cover their costs of interacting with payers. So there would be sort of a reduced overhead for physician practices. Similarly, I think hospitals will be able to downsize their administrative apparatus as well. Hospitals spend about a quarter of their total revenue on administration and billing. That's about twice the proportion of Canada, so you can see room for savings there. The biggest change, of course, will come for the private insurers, because they're going to be replaced. And that's, you know, I'm not so much worried about the CEO of those insurers, but I am worried about the workers. And there is provisions in both the Medicare for All bills in the House and Senate to provide you know, money for training and salary support for displaced workers. So it's a big change.
But it is important to highlight, I mean, just the magnitude of the difference in payments between what Medicare pays and what private insurance pays. We've got some really good studies on that in the last few years. And the gap is pretty large. Private insurers pay about twice as much to hospitals, nearly twice as much to hospitals as Medicare pays for the same procedure. Primary care doctors are paid actually similarly, but specialists get paid also much more, often twice as much, if not more. So moving to a Medicare payment base would have a significant impact on doctors and hospitals and drug companies. Medicaid pays less than half of what private insurers paid. So if you went to a sort of a Medicaid-style drug payment system, you'd save a lot of money, but I think there would be a little less innovation in the system. I think it's also important to acknowledge one of the things about Medicare or traditional Medicare, fee-for-service Medicare, that people like is that it's not very managed, right? You don't have to go through these hoops to get things approved and so forth. And that's all well and good. That could be a good thing to move to a system like that, but that's a more expensive system than we have, because one of the things private insurers are doing is trying to hold down costs. Again, you can dislike the way they do that. I'm not trying to pass judgment on that, but it's a less managed system is a more costly system. All else equal.
Do you guys envision any broader changes? We're in Boston, and here we have these amazing academic medical centers that are doing kind of unusual and high-end work, but also are able to command, really tremendous prices from private insurance currently. Though it strikes me that the partners, or they've renamed themselves, and I've forgotten the new name.
Partners.
Yeah,
they did change.
Is an example of a hospital group that would have to do things kind of differently under Medicare for All, right? If they're going to be paid substantially less on average, what will that look like for them? Do you think that we will see less differentiation between hospitals? Do you think we'll see some hospitals just really having to make major changes?
I think this is one of the reasons why you will never see it, simply because the differential impact. So a Cambridge hospital probably would have a fairly easy, smooth transition. And a large hospital with a large commercial base where they're making substantial sums relative to what Medicare or Medicaid pays would have some wrenching, downsizing to do to be able to survive in this new system. Of course, a lot of it is hypothetical because you don't know. You hear different statements from candidates, well, I'll pay 110% of Medicare, I'll pay 120%, some people say 160%. Until you actually see that, CBO can't do a score and tell you which end is really up on any of this. So a lot of it is hypothetical, but I think what it shows is that, in a transition to a Medicare for All, you would have a vast number of Americans, a vast number of providers and other institutions and businesses who would do really well and be really happy. They may not know it or appreciate it, and you'd have a significant number who would be significantly under the gun and disadvantaged and harmed by this transition. And more people tend to assume that they're going to be on the losing end rather than the winning end, and that's what makes it so politically perilous.
So this is a great opportunity to come back to you, Bob, and talk a little bit about the politics of this, what we know from the survey that you conducted and from public opinion work more generally. How important an issue is healthcare going to be? We see voters say it's their number one issue, but how deciding of an issue it is, and how much do you think this debate within the Democratic Party is going to shape who wins the primary?
So let me make a quick point for the audience. The United States not only differs in the healthcare system, it does in the political system. The British picked their candidate for prime minister, Conservative Party, in 1 month. We do a year for the Democrats. Why that's important is that only 20% of adults are going to vote in that primary. And it turns out when you interview the other 80, they don't place big health reform. And when they say healthcare, that is not their top issue. Their top issue is the prices they're paying. This is a real pocketbook. So when you independents, they could get scared about Medicare for All, about that. But they're not looking for a reform. Nobody, when you said, what is healthcare to you? They don't say, I want a new ACA with five different things attached to it. They say the drug prices are unreasonable. And look at the number of ads people are trying to get into this about drug prices. And then I say the co-pays and deductibles are killing me, and the prices, and why does the ER? So for the average voter, they want to vote for someone who will deal with medical bills, which looks like we cannot get out of the U.S. Congress, drug prices. Then why are we talking about this over a year? Because unlike other countries, which pick their candidate in a month, We do it over a year. So this will be over in July, and then they'll all be writing their talks, and then it will be November. So we have a problem. The American voter says healthcare is important, but it's not this debate. But in the Democratic primary, this issue is decisive for that. So I want to warn you about that. This is a meat and potatoes issue for the average person not voting in a Democratic primary. I want to see something done about these insulin costs, et cetera, et cetera, and tell me the damn House is going to do something. That's what they're talking about, but not for the 20% who vote in a Democratic primary. So they have elevated this to their top issue, and then somebody grabs a poll and says, oh, see, healthcare is the big issue. But that's not actually what people not voting in the primary say. It's this other type of healthcare, and that's what scares them about Medicare for all. If you could just talk about, I'll pay less next year, you really have a take. But when you get into the trillions in this, people who can't deal with a trillion say to themselves, I don't know what a trillion is, but at the end of the day, I'm going to be paying more. And in reality, if you could say your fees will go down, your this, your when delivery costs go down, your drug costs will go down, that would be a debate that the other people would like to have. But that is lost in the aggregate numbers.
And that's probably one political selling point for Medicare for All, is that you can emphasize the elimination of out-of-pocket expenditures, which, you know, we talk a lot about national health spending and federal spending. I think for a lot of average voters, they're really thinking about out-of-pocket at the time of healthcare use, yes, even if that's a relatively small proportion of our total healthcare spending. So it may, you know, be a winning political argument to be able to say, well, this is, you know, we're talking about eliminating copays and deductibles, which are sort of what people are seeing.
Can I just make one more point, and then you're going to drive me out of the room? The majority of Americans think we do not spend enough of the GNP on health. I'm sorry. They have no worry about aggregate spending, nor do they believe if the government saved 10% of that, it would go to something that they care about. So their concern about cost is all about individual cost issues. It is not about aggregate spending. If you want to have an aggregate spending argument, talk about defense spending. And Americans want to pull that lever back a lot more than they're worried about the aggregate side. It is their own cost issues. And as John hit, because employers pay so much of it, they don't fully see the aggregate. They see what they pay every month. And so it's a different, at the grassroots level, it's a different argument.
Do Americans know how much we spend on healthcare?
No.
No. I didn't think so.
They think it's too expensive, but not in the national aggregate. Mm-hmm. No, you have to have a year at CBO to get into that discussion.
So all of you guys have been working in this area and thinking about these issues for a really long time. And I'm curious how you think about the sort of political trajectory of the idea of Medicare for All. I mean, there obviously has been a movement in the United States for a very long time among some advocates to try to push a single payer vision for what healthcare in America could look like. And that hasn't gotten a lot of kind of mainstream traction before the last few years. You know, it's something that's always been part of the debate. We see it in other countries. We see people who advocate for it. But it strikes me that Bernie Sanders' presidential campaign in 2016 did a lot to really popularize this idea and bring it into the mainstream of at least the Democratic Party's policy debate. And now we do see these public opinion polls where maybe it's not causing people to make a forced choice among policies, but you ask them, do you like the idea of Medicare for All? And we kind of see consistently majorities of Americans seem open to the idea. Why do you guys think this is happening now? Has something changed? Do you think that the trajectory is one in which people are going to become more and more comfortable with this idea as we talk about it in public, or is this the ceiling?
I think there's always been a substantial part, particularly of the Democratic Party base, that agreed with single payer even before Medicare for All became the term of art. And so it's not new. Bernie Sanders deserves a huge amount of the credit or blame, whichever you prefer, for really popularizing it and making it such a signally important issue. Elizabeth Warren helped until her financing plan, I think, gave her a busted tire on the highway to the presidential nomination. But there's a challenge in what I find difficult about this. I have a huge amount of sympathy for the motivation behind Medicare for All. I mean, we have a system that is just failing on so many levels. I mean, lower life expectancy 3 years in a row, extraordinary epidemic of obesity and overweight, gun violence, so many important issues where we are just failing in awful ways. And Medicare for All is probably one of the pieces that would more change the trajectory of our system. But then I get down to the raw politics of it. You have to get it through Congress. There's no way in the next 10 years a single Republican senator or House member would vote for this. So you need at least 60 Democratic votes to get this done. If the Democrats have a glorious, successful next November, they will, against the odds, have a Senate with 51 or 52 Democratic votes at best. So it's a nice conversation, and it's going nowhere. I mean, there's no short-term future for it at all, unless you can tell me. I mean, how does this have a snowball's chance in hell, Adam?
So you're making the case for that this is not a politically feasible concept. And I think if you look at history, every major significant reform felt infeasible until it was achieved. I mean, civil rights certainly felt not like a feasible, you know, a prospect of winning before it was achieved. Gay rights, I mean, the fall of the Berlin Wall. We could go on and on. I think that, you know, yes, I fully agree that there's major political obstacles to achieving something this big. But again, there's been many reforms that have been achieved in history and that have surmounted obstacles of this nature. You know, the other issue, I think, and to kind of respond to Margaret's question, I mean, this is a part of a longer struggle. It's not something new. I mean, Harry Truman embraced a national health insurance plan in the late 1940s. That was sunk in large part by the American Medical Association. But I think that's, you know, a very instructive example, because I think in the provider side, you are seeing physicians moving closer and closer towards an embrace of Medicare for All. And that's a big difference. Again, there was the next time we really tried to do something like this, I think it was the 1970s, when Medicare had been achieved and there was an effort to say, let's move beyond that and achieve universal coverage. And that was defeated. And now here we are again. And why is that? I think, you know, Sanders played a role. I think the shift to a discussion about inequality has made a major role. And I think you are seeing a openness to progressive ideas and progressive candidates in a way that, you know, I haven't seen in my lifetime. It's not any one factor, but I disagree with John's point. I think that this is an achievable goal, and it's up to us to sort of make that case to the American public.
You know, in the past 40 years, Democrats have had what they call trifecta control in Washington, D.C., for only two-year stints, 93, 94 under Bill Clinton, his first 2 years, and 09 and 10 under Barack Obama, his first 2 years. Each of them made health reform their signal main issue. And very little else happened. Clinton lost, Obama won, and then they lost Congress after those two-year terms. And so I think there's a need, particularly because, you know, healthcare is vitally important, but so is climate change. So is voting rights, so is gun control. And there's a way when health reform is on the agenda, it sucks up all the political oxygen in the room, and there's very little room or space for anything. And I think people who care about healthcare care about all of these other concerns, and I think we have to be pragmatic in terms of how we might use another episode of trifecta reform that might last more than 2 years. Because the consequences are severe for not just for health, but for everything else we care about.
I mean, the counterpoints to that are the New Deal, when reform was sought in a wide variety of areas at the same time, and a lot was done. The Great Society, no one said we should just focus on Medicaid and not do civil rights, and not do civil rights, and not do Medicaid. I think if you look at American history, many times, many important reforms can be sought and achieved at the same time. And that's what we're hoping for looking forward.
All right, Bob, I'm going to let you have the last word on this question.
So quickly, on between our two colleagues, in the short term, it's very hard to read the political tea leaves and see this could happen. But this is, if you follow what's happening in the Democratic Party, is the Democratic Party is moving unbelievably to the left. And the people in it are increasing, particularly young people, dissatisfied with the U.S. economic system. Inequality, unfairness, racism, genderism. And if you look at the answers, their love of how private markets work is just declining. There's an age difference and everything else. So if I look in the next 4 years, I can't imagine going this. But for those of you who need humility here, the first poll showed that 10% of Britons were interested in leaving the European Union. And then the next poll said, no way could you be prime minister, favoring it. For it. And now, of course, they'll live in the European Union. This shift doesn't mean we're going to go that way, but there is within the Democratic Party and young people a disillusionment with current American institutions for that. Whether or not that will be the dominant issue 10 years from now is not clear. But I think if I was betting in 10 years, I would hedge my bets. I'd buy John and I'd buy my colleague over here. because you don't know, but there's a real shift, and the polarization of a doesn't go away in this country means we're going to see big swings. You're going to go where the Republicans will win and they will try to saw off every single thing that's enacted. And then the Democrats will come back 8 years later and try to have sweeping things. But the Democratic Party is changing, and the young people in particular are very disillusioned with existing private institutions and how they work. If it'll play out with all these others, I can't tell you. But when you see these numbers, you say to yourself, over time, we could find the equivalent of a med exit. People decide they want to exit out of the existing healthcare system. But in the short term, you can't see how that. But long-term trends are very different at the moment in the country.
So we're almost out of time, unfortunately. I could talk with you guys about this forever. I wanted to give each of our panelists an opportunity to give us like one great takeaway from this conversation, something that all of you guys should think about as you go home and that you guys have thought about as a result of this conversation. And Phil, if you don't mind me putting you on the spot, will you start us off?
Sure. Well, I'll just say again, health reform is hard, and the more expensive and the more disruptive it is, the harder it is. It's just the fact of life. So in the short run, I would say it's a big lift. In the longer run, we'll see.
On a slightly more optimistic note, I think one thing that makes healthcare reform a little bit easier is the fact that the money is already there. We're already spending the money. We just need to spend it smarter in order to be able to cover the uninsured and cover the underinsured.
John?
The principal pain points that Bob articulated so well can be addressed in the next Congress in a way that doesn't require 60 Democratic votes in the Senate. We can fix this and address some of the critical issues that are most hurting Americans. If I were to say I got to put all my chips on the table for one thing to do in 2021 if Democrats control all three, climate change. That's what we got to do. That's a global threat to humanity and to all the other species we like to hang around with. And I think there's a need to be strategic and important, and climate change is very much about public health.
So I agree with Bob, and the people's concerns are about their healthcare costs. And there are things to do that we in Congress could do tomorrow to improve that. They could expand enhance marketplace subsidies, fill the Medicaid coverage gap, do little things like that that would actually help millions of people better afford their coverage and able to get covered for the first time. I think there is somewhat of a disconnect between the other part we're talking about, which is lowering the overall growth rate of healthcare spending, and by really addressing that provider price issue that these plans are doing. But I don't think that the public can really see that connection, that those are driving their current cost concerns. So it's a matter of public policy, and it's important for us to talk about it, but consumers don't necessarily see that linkage.
Bob?
It's simple. Over the next 10 years, polls are not going to matter. What's going to matter is who's elected to office. And these are visible issues. Candidates will be running with across their sweatshirts for plan A, B, or C. If you want the outcome to look different, it matters who's elected. And it's not going to be resolved by either a study or a poll or anything else. We are in a situation where who wins will determine the end of this debate.
So that's a wrap. I just want to thank all of our panelists. This has been a really interesting conversation. You guys are great. Thank you so much to our audience for being a good audience. And everything is online in all the places that I said before if you want to share this conversation with other people. Thanks.
This has been a production of The Forum at Harvard T.H. Chan School of Public Health. You can find the complete video of this event and post your comments at www.forumhsph.org. Thank you for sharing the forum.